Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and hosted by Eli Mazur. If you enjoy listening, please subscribe on your favorite podcasting app, share it with others, and leave a 5-star rating. And if you're not already a regular IP Watchdog reader, check it out and sign up for the email list to get daily updates. This episode features an interview with Josh Malone, the inventor of Buncha Balloons and America's foremost advocate for reliable patent rights. Josh came up with the idea for Buncha Balloons to help his kids fill up 100 water balloons in less than 1 minute. It eventually became the most popular toy in America. However, before Buncha Balloons even came to market, another company copied it and started selling its own versions of the product. Luckily, or so we thought at the time, Josh filed a patent application for his Buncha Balloons inventions. He did not know the enormous amount of time, money, and luck it would have to take to successfully enforce patents that covered his invention. This episode tells a story of what it took, including taking a trip to Bentonville, Arkansas in the middle of the night to try to convince Walmart to stop selling knockoffs of his product.
Thank you so much for doing this. And I guess before we dive into the questions, I'm curious, how did that movie come about, the documentary, and how did you end up being featured? And
I got a call from the producer or an email, and they had heard about my story and invited me to participate. And I was happy that someone wanted to help tell the story.
And I know that it was in the middle of a litigation that you had going on. I know a lot of people are very worried about saying anything publicly when they're involved in litigation. I guess, did that give you any concerns, or did you think that's a story that needs to be told?
Yeah, having, you know, the first year and a half or so, I was very timid about speaking about the case. But then, you know, they tell you to just be quiet, let the lawyers handle it, but it wasn't getting handled. And then I found out that the big corporations have an entire PR campaign when they're in litigation. I had no idea until I serendipitously stepped into the public relations side of litigation. Yeah. So it was a good decision.
Yeah, that's interesting. And hopefully we could touch on more. Before we go into your case, I'm interested in, and this is a question that I ask everybody, do you remember when you first learned about patents, and what was your impression about the role that they play in America?
Well, I was introduced to, everyone knows about patents. You know, I don't know where you learn about in school or whatever, but as an engineer and a technology company, I had opportunities to create solutions to problems, and I would file a disclosure, and some of those I got patents on. Very quintessentially American. I mean, a lot of people dream about being an inventor. That was part of it. If you're an inventor, you get a patent. So I just...
As long as you remember, you knew about patents and you've been interested in inventing and...
Yeah, it just grew. For me, it wasn't... The patents just came with the package. Like, I was a problem solver, and I started thinking about more and more problems and desiring to find solutions for them. And then I got the idea that, hey, I could do this. Working for a corporation, you're 21, 22 years old. You're like, dang, I'm going to get a salary. I'll sign whatever employee agreement they put in front of me. And a few years later, you have these ideas, and you're like, what do I do with this? Can I go file a patent? And you ask your boss. He's like, well, you got to, you know, the company owns all your intellectual property you signed. And so you start thinking about how you can renegotiate that, or you save it. You put it on the side and you don't work on it. You don't trigger that. You don't want to trigger giving that over to the company if it's got a lot of value, especially when it's a different field. I worked with a lot of guys that just were mechanical engineers, electrical engineers. You know, we're not only solving problems in the semiconductor space. We've got one buddy wanted to create a continuously variable transmission for a bicycle. Like, yeah, you should be able to own that. It has nothing to do with what they hired you to do.
So what was the first invention that you had that you filed a patent application for outside of your professional job at a corporation?
Yeah, I quit my job to launch a product. It was a digital paper cutter. And so I was able to take a field that didn't have the right tools for the job, and scrapbooking and craft card making. And I created a solution, a little portable digital paper cutter, and solved some problems along the way and filed for patents.
After that, you had other innovations and you filed, and then you, in the movie Invalidated, you see that your kids were having a problem where they loved playing with water balloons, but it was taking forever for them to fill it up. And you said, this is a problem they're having. I'm going to find the solution to it. A lot of people, they run into problems and they say, I wish there was a solution. What about you? It makes you go, not only do I wish that solution, but I will find that solution. What makes you different from a normal person, I'd say, or the average person?
So I take it really just one, it's one step forward from I wish there were a solution to there's got to be a solution. And then I've got to find it. So, I mean, that's what inventors do. Like, we're not satisfied with the status quo. If something doesn't work right, if it's too tedious, if it costs too much, we look for a better way. Yeah.
And obviously, there's some engineering involved. So not to get too complex, but for those of us who aren't inventors, can you give us a little bit of insight? How do you go about solving a problem? How do you go about figuring out a solution? Do you research or like,
it's not
how does it become a bunch of balloons?
It's not linear for me. You know, I think it's a weird line between an engineer and a scientist and an inventor. For me, it's just kind of getting outside the box and saying, are there other ways to do this? How do other industries solve similar problems? Some of it goes on your experience, what you've learned and observed, but then it's all these pieces are there, which maybe we'll talk a little bit about the obviousness doctrine later on, but we don't create it from scratch. The elements are there, the molecules are there, the components are there, but finding these different components and combining them in creative ways, modifying them in creative ways, for me, it's kind of thinking about the function. I think a lot about in terms of function. We can talk about that too, because there's talk about changing the law and for Section 112 on functional claiming. But a lot of it's just thinking about what's the mechanism? What are the different mechanisms? Is this more of an application for a lever or a spring? Or is there some, you know, or why not elastic? And elastics is a really crazy material. Like, there's all these synthetics, but then natural latex rubber has the most incredible properties. And so just this collective experience of how things work and how they respond to inputs, finding new ways to put them together.
That's interesting. Bunch of balloons. At what point did you realize that it might not only be great for your family, but it might be popular all over America?
Yeah. Well, if I have a household problem, I have to be able to solve it in an amount of time that it pays back. Like, either that one thing, or maybe it's something I'm going to use every spring or every winter. And so the return on investment has to work out. And so you don't spend thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours trying to solve a better way to get the leaves out of your gutter. I always thought, this goes back to your first question, I always thought, but if I do solve it, it could have some commercial value. And if I solve it in a way no one's ever thought of before, I can actually own the rights to that solution. And so I'll pursue it. And if it solves a problem for me, maybe it'll solve the problem for someone else. From there, I start looking at commercial viability. Is this something that could be mass produced? Would it meet the right price point? But it kind of evolves.
Going back, obviously, a bunch of balloons weren't your first patents, but for an innovator out there and they're trying to think about, all right, I know I need to get a patent. Can you tell us a little bit about how did you go through that process? Did you go try to find a patent attorney? How did you decide? There's so many patent attorneys. Some of them are bad. Some of them are good. How did you go through that process of figuring out?
Yeah, same problem with litigation attorneys. From my background at Texas Instruments, some of my colleagues, well, I knew patent attorneys, worked for and we outsourced a lot of that work. I knew those guys, and even some of my colleagues who I worked with in engineering had gone on to become patent attorneys. That's a great reminder of that blessing, having those connections. It's because you don't know where to start. People just have no idea where to start. So I was really fortunate.
That's good. And what advice would you give to somebody who's trying to figure out, well, is he a good patent attorney? Or
send an email to Eli and ask him what he should do.
Good advice. All right. And obviously you had some experience about it, but the tricky part about it is you come up with an invention and then you have to come up with the claims that cover it in the way that needs to be covered. And some people, you know, it's a very hard thing for people to kind of wrap their minds around it. They're like, well, I came up with it, and just because I added an extra word here or there to describe in the claim, why shouldn't it cover the invention? You went through a process, but what did you think about that aspect of it?
I thought I understood it. Claiming makes a lot of sense as a concept, but it's not as easy as the industry makes it out to be. So it's easy to write a picture claim. It's also easy to design around a picture claim. And so I knew that. I mean, I knew when I started getting claim language back, I'm like, well, there's loopholes in this. Okay. So this doesn't cover the extent of my invention. That process, it started early and it went on for years. I spent hundreds of hours trying to frame the claim in the exact right language. And I was doing it while these guys were attacking my claim. And so I was anticipating many of the points of attack. It's not easy to define that precise boundary between what you invented and enabled and what came before you. It's hard.
And it's interesting. You were thinking about the design around issue during this process already. And I was going to talk about it later. But one of the issues that came up during litigation is your original claim to one of your independent claim, one of your first patent for a bunch of balloons, had the words substantially filled with water, which was part of the contention. Did you have any inkling at that point when you were coming up with the original claim language that that might cause any issue, or was that kind of a surprise for you when that came about?
No, I didn't anticipate an issue. That happened in prosecution. We had, I don't know if you can call it infringement, but they had already copied my design, flooding the marketplace with it, knowing I had a patent pending. It's a weird place, right? When you're taught that you can protect your invention with a provisional patent or a pending patent, but not necessarily. But I still feel like, you know, the inventor should own the rights to the invention. I mean, that's the whole point of the system. So we had to get a patent out in order to, I thought, to make them stop. But really, that just meant we got to go to court. They weren't going to stop just because I had a patent. And so it was a negotiation with the patent office. We had to take a narrower claim set than we thought we were entitled to. And that language had been used in the prosecution in a dependent claim. And we're like, get you an allowance if you take this examiner's amendment. And we're like, they're selling like 100,000 units a week. So give me that claim and give me my patent. So
that was going to be my next question, but what you thought about the examination process. I actually looked up the statistics for the examiner that handled your case, and he's more stringent than other examiners in that R unit, considerably. It seems that you might have encountered that during the process, but what do you think about the examination process as a whole? There's a lot of debate about quality. Some people think the examiners aren't thorough enough. Obviously, some inventors who have limited funds think they need to spend way too much resources trying to get that patent. Do you have any thoughts about the examination process itself?
My examiner was outstanding and stringent. I agree with you. I think most of them are good examiners. I think that this meme of bad patents and not enough time and poor examination, it doesn't correspond with the reality. This examiner found the first application, I think he found 99 prior art references, and he found all the references that were later litigated. He didn't miss anything. And also, you know, in retrospect, I see now that, and for first-time inventors, they really need to understand this, you're not going to get the full scope of your invention on the first patent. They're going to give you a narrower claim set. And so it's a compromise. You want a patent, you got to take the narrow claims and then pursue the rest of it in a continuation.
You made a lot of sophisticated decisions like that with that. You knew, you filed provisionals, you filed continuation applications. You know, you could have just gotten that first patent and say, this will be enough. And then you filed applications internationally as well. I'm thinking about that first-time inventor. Would a first-time inventor know to do all that? And I guess, what advice would you give to figuring out what you need to do? And
well, setting aside, let's say hypothetically we had a patent system where you can enforce your patents. My advice right now is don't disclose your inventions to the patent office. You're just giving it away. But let's assume we had a reasonable expectation of being able to enforce our patents. In that case, there's some things inventors can do to preserve their rights. The most important is to get a very thorough, robust disclosure. Actually, I have an ongoing dialogue with, I'm trying to solve this conundrum. To me, I always thought the provisional was important, but not as important as the non-provisional. The more I think about it, that provisional, I think Gene Quinn says file early and file often. So I think that's the advice. You got to file everything about your invention, both broad and deep. Describe it every which way you can. That's not the time to try to be precise. And so that's something I didn't understand. All inventors need to be very thorough. Lots of drawings, lots of description about actually what the embodiments are. You got to focus on the actual embodiments to the nth degree. And then also alternative embodiments as much as you can. And I think my application was 4 or 5 pages. And it's this pretty simple technology, but still, that was close. I barely got enough disclosure out there to be able to get the claims I needed to protect the invention. So you got a very thorough application at the provisional stage, and every few weeks you should file another one, adding any new material and keep preserving that. And then everything after that can be solved with continuations. So you got a patent pending, you're good. You're in the game.
And there's a lot of, obviously, we're going to discuss about how the patent system might not be working, but on the theoretical level, we know how it should work, that you give somebody a patent and they're incentivized to innovate, they're incentivized to invest in it, to bring it to market. On a practical level for you, the fact that you were filing patents, applications, and that you were getting patents, I mean, what impact did it have on you bringing the bunch of balloons to market? Can you give us that kind of perspective?
Well, so I partnered with a toy company, did an exclusive license. They were going to invest heavily in this production equipment and the factory and the inventory and the marketing. So they needed that exclusivity, which comes from the patent. That was important. And then when your invention is stolen or copied, then the patent gives you some form of a weapon of varying effectiveness to make the bad guys stop. It's not automatic. It's not like it says on the front of the patent, it's the right to exclude others from practicing the claimed invention. Not necessarily, but it does allow you to hire a bunch of attorneys and go draw blood from the guys who stole your invention.
So it seems without a patent, you wouldn't have been able to find a licensee who's willing to invest and bring that to market.
A lot of products, especially in light of the difficulty enforcing, you could go down a path without a patent. You've just got to have a plan for returning on your investment quick enough or in competition. And many products and many maybe inventions could be pursued that way, and you save a lot of money and a lot of grief not going down the patent route. But you're going to have to compete on other ways. So, but others, you know, in my case, obviously the patent did work out at the end.
And from your experience, when somebody's licensing your patent, do they stringently examine it to make sure that it's a high quality patent and that it's something really worthwhile? What is that process like? Because you're kind of in the negotiation as well, I imagine, with the licensee, right?
Yeah. Well, in the patent litigation, there's two very different industries, and it's almost all driven by patent assertion campaigns and investors. They care about the quality. They care about the pedigree, and they have all sorts of tools to analyze it. That's very important if you're going to sell your patent or assert it. They look very carefully. On the other hand, if you're looking to produce a hard good and sell it in the market, they just want to know that you have a patent pending. In very, very few industries, I don't think they look closely at what it covers. Now, they might. If they're bad actors, they'll look at your patent just to know where your claims are and how they're going to, what their arguments are going to be when negotiations break down. And I've heard from many inventors where they spend a year or two under an NDA or not teaching their technology to a potential partner, and then all of a sudden they go dark and their invention shows up under this company's brand. So, but they want to see your patent. They care about how good it is because they want to know if they can get around it or how easy it's going to be to get around it.
That's interesting. At least it seems from your experiences, your licensees just wanted to know that you had a patent.
The good guys that are going to take your invention and produce it, commercialize it, they're not sophisticated enough to really know about exactly how good your patent is.
And I know, obviously, when you get a patent, there's that possibility of having to enforce it one day, but did you ever think about that it would be something that you would have to deal with on a realistic basis? Did you have an awareness of there's these, I guess, bad actors that in the business of making knockoff products and so forth?
Well, I thought there would be nuisances. I thought there would be, you know, Chinese knockoffs on eBay. I assumed a patent would help remedy that. I had no idea that they would just, let me step back a little bit. I mean, I honestly, and this is something I deal with when I work with inventors now, quit my job in 2006. I had no idea that the Supreme Court was flipping our patent on its head, this patent system on its head through the eBay decision. 2011, that's when I started my third phase of this adventure. That's when Congress passed the American Invents Act. And by 2014, the PTAB was well on its way. I had no idea at that time. I thought a patent normally meant, I mean, I thought the normal thing was people are not going to cross this. I had no idea how little respect. I had no idea about this business model of efficient infringement. And so I think most inventors still today aren't aware that their patent isn't respected by it. I mean, big corporations are like, and it makes sense. Why should I deal with this inventor? He might be crazy. He probably wants too much for his invention. Before they know it, they just hand it over to the attorneys and are like, you guys deal with this.
I don't know if this is correct, but in the movie Invalidated, it said that you had a Kickstarter campaign and it went national. You were on the Today Show and you had all these large toy manufacturers approaching you. I mean, did you have an opportunity to kind of just sell them the patent and let them, they have a deep pockets to deal with these bad actors. Did you have an opportunity like that at that point, or how did you decide, I guess?
No, all the terms were always a licensing deal. There's just, even after, there wasn't a way to value a patent at that point. It turns out it's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. No one's going to pay anywhere near the value of the patent at that stage.
Is there a way to structure it there where the licensee has to cover the legal costs?
That's more or less how ours worked. I mean, obviously, I didn't have the capital to bring a multi-million dollar litigation. So it worked out well because the licensee in this case was, you know, they had enough capital and enough experience to start the litigation. We were really fortunate. We sold enough product to finish it. So that was just another miracle in this, is my partner was just had the right tenacity, the right will, and this was their flagship product. I had a conversation with Hasbro, and yeah, I feel like if I'd have done that deal, they would have been like, this is a headache. We can sell more Tonka trucks and Matchbox and make a lot, you know, we make billions of dollars selling stuff where we don't have to have these headaches. I don't think they would have fought. So we ended up fighting side by side. So a lot of inventors, it's kind of weird. I didn't expect to, but I worked so hard to get here and they helped me get started. But I started watching the litigation. I started watching, I mean, this whole PTAB thing. When the patent office starts taking my patents back, I'm getting involved personally. Especially this was just, you know, I could go back to inventing, but I'm never going to come up with anything close to this successful. So it was well worth my attention to make sure that we were able to succeed. So I got heavily involved in the litigation.
So in some sense, you were lucky that you got the right licensee because, for example, your example, Hasbro could have just given up in the beginning.
Well, they could have been too big and they're like, we don't need this headache. I've met many inventors who did a license and then their licensee got knocked off. And then the licensee goes back to the inventor and says, hey, you got to stop them. We can't stop them. Or we got IPR'd, so you got to go take care of that. And before you know it, the licensee is like, why are we paying the inventor? Our competitors don't have to pay him. So they quit paying his royalty. And then he has to sue his licensee. So if they're too small, they can't enforce the patents. If they're too big, they're not going to bother to enforce the patent. It was the Goldilocks partnership.
In your case, the villain of the story is Tell Brands, which is that as seen on TV company, which was doing the majority of the knockoffs. When you first found out about it, did you think you could amicably resolve it? Like, if I explain to them I have a patent covering this, I guess, what was your feeling about how it would get resolved at that point?
I read the books and the articles about Telebrands. It became very clear that there would be no negotiation. Although that's how these other cases, ultimately there is a negotiation where they're basically, we'll pay you much less or zero, we'll let you out of the lawsuit. In fact, one inventor actually got counterclaimed, and to get out of the suit, they throw all these charges, like tortious interference is their favorite. You go find these people who are selling, which isn't an infringing act. Their retail partners are selling the product, and you tell them to stop. And so Telebrands immediately files a counterclaim, says, you're tortiously interfering with our business. Well, no, I'm not. I'm enforcing my patent rights. And so this one lady had to pay them $400,000, mortgage her house, lose everything to get out of the suit. And so that's how others have had licenses for, I'm sure, pennies on the dollar. There was not going to be a fair, and also we wanted exclusive rights because we were investing in this product and we had a brand, we had quality standards. We had no desire to partner with these guys. And it was, I remember like a year and a half into the litigation, we had to go to a mediation, court ordered mediation. And the tone there was, it was all like, you know, what are the terms going to be? You're going to give them this market. And I'm like, no, they have to stop. The mediator and the attorneys there, they were just kind of flabbergasted. And they're like, why would, you know, because they knew about eBay. I'm the only non-attorney in the room. And I'm saying, but my constitution says that I have the right to exclude. They're like, no, that's not even part of the conversation. So it took years to get to the point of where these guys realized that they didn't have the right to sell my invention. It took years of litigation for that reality to set in.
And I want to talk a little about the injunction piece of it. I think is very interesting of your story. But you mentioned the retail partners, and that was a problem. I read an another interview with you where you said, surprisingly, actually, Amazon is pretty good with your experience with if somebody's selling products that infringe patents, they'll take them off. And they actually have a new program for that. I'm not sure you've heard about it. I guess Walmart wasn't responsive. Can you talk about that? What was that like? I mean, how do you approach a company like Amazon? And what happened when you approached Walmart? Did they just ignore you, or how did they kind of deal with it?
Well, with Amazon, it's a bureaucracy. They've got so many products, and then they do this safe harbor. We're just a platform. And so they make you do all the work, but the procedures are nearly impossible to police. But what I found was with the right intellectual property rights, copyrights are pretty good for enforcement. I would guess design patents are pretty good. With utility patents, they don't want to construe claims. That's harder. But it was really a lot of diligence and a lot of methodology. I think there's services now that have figured this out. Well, I figured it out on my own. I lost 6 months of my life issuing takedown notices on Amazon. You don't issue a takedown notice and then wait. Every day, you search the listings. It takes a couple hours a day. Search the listings. You fill out the form. And by the way, you also have to answer all their template questions, because otherwise you can get an email back that says, answer these 7 questions. So I worked through Amazon. And then the other key with Amazon was once we got a court order, I was able to take that to Amazon and get them to respond to that. Now we turn to Walmart. We got a court order in joining Telebrands, but days before the order issues, they ship hundreds of thousands of units into Walmart. And then I go to Walmart and I say, well, we won the order. We were right after all. Because, of course, they take this position of we're not going to get involved in this dispute. Once we had a judge say we were more than likely correct and issue an injunction, I would have thought Walmart would pull the product then. They said, well, no, our name's not on that order. And so I had to go sue these retailers who we want to carry our product. It creates a mess.
Are you able to have a conversation with somebody at Walmart, or is it kind of all, am I being Pollyannish about it? It's like they just ignore you and they just send you formal emails and you got to through the lawyers.
There's several layers, but this happened multiple times. So we had one injunction. The next year it happened again. And I remember I'm in my home office in Plano. I pull up the issuances for the week on Tuesday. Was it Tuesday? Every Tuesday night or something? And my patent issues. And it was like midnight. It was like shortly after midnight when they published. And I got it. And then I got in my car. I drove 6 hours to Bentonville, Arkansas. And I demanded to meet with the VP of legal. And they didn't know what to do with it. They just let me in before they realized what I was. But it was
So that's a good story. So you were waiting for this moment. You got the pattern.
No, I didn't. I decided the spur of the moment.
Okay.
Otherwise, I was going to send another email and they were going to jerk me around again. And I'm just like, no, I'm going to nip this in the bud and go tell them to stop.
So you get there and you actually meet with the VP of legal. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a pleasant conversation, but he's like, you guys got to win the business. We're going to do whatever we can get away with was basically. He didn't use those words. And then later on, I remember I guess they had multiple attorneys. We had a conversation at another point where we had won our second injunction and we were having a conversation about settlement. They were cutting off our business. They weren't going to sell our product if we didn't drop the suit. It was bad. And I remember explaining how we had prevailed, and the Walmart attorney and their outside counsel are like, well, you haven't won yet. You just got an order from the Eastern District of Texas. That doesn't count. And that's what these people think. You look at what Apple's doing in their litigation, like, and they all believe that they haven't done anything wrong. I tell them they're violating my patent. You're breaking the law. Like, we're not doing anything wrong because you haven't won yet. They view it as it's okay as long as you haven't won in court. And that's how they treat patents.
At least Amazon has a huge bureaucracy. It's a huge pain for inventors and licensees like you. But at least there's a process where if you actually get some kind of court order that they'll respect. While Walmart, at least from your experience, they're like, we're not going to care about these issues until a court forces our hands. Is that what kind of the... They're not going to...
Yeah.
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 I mean, they don't care if they sell the product that infringes.
Amazon, you know, Amazon's, and they're in a precarious position. They have to walk that line because this safe harbor thing, I don't think it's going to hold up. And I think the president has just issued an executive order that's going to, we'll see what the courts decide about all that. But I remember when they had a case, the Milo and Gabby case, that took them all the way to the federal circuit. Once they get a complaint filed, they start policing the marketplace. There wasn't even any infringement, but as this case went through the courts for 3 or 4 years, they were keeping the product pretty clean. So Yeah, I can't remember that. I didn't quite answer your question. I went in circles there.
The other half of that question was with the Walmart, it's not that they care or don't care about IP rights. They just, they're not going to even bother kind of looking into the situation.
Yeah, well, yeah. It goes to indemnification. They require their vendor to handle everything. I was surprised the other retailers, that relationship started to break down by the third year when they, you know, this Telebrands keeps going to their retailers saying, we're right, he's wrong, his patent's invalid. And, you know, the first year, everyone believed him. They're like, yep, you're a great vendor. We do tens of millions of dollars in business with you every year and you never lose. The second year, they lost a couple of accounts. By the third year, Walmart was and Walgreens were the only ones that would do business, and Toys R Us, but Toys R Us went bankrupt. So there's a few of them that just, they're just stand behind their indemnification and they're like, you take care of this. In one case, we actually did get Walmart. It was somewhat painful because they made Telebrands pay for their Wilmer Hale outside attorneys. Yeah. So Telebrands had to pay cash to fulfill their indemnification. Yeah. So, but that's kind of how they've approached it. Like, we don't have to follow the law. We're going to make our suppliers liable. We're going to make them, we'll do whatever they tell us to do.
There's obviously buyers at Walmart that decide, I'm going to buy products from this person and this person. You have the story. You're the inventor. You came up with it. You think from their perspective, they'd rather deal with somebody like you.
Most inventors can't compete because it's all about lowest prices.
Lowest prices.
It's not just Walmart. It's lowest prices. And these guys will go make cheap knockoffs and undercut your price. That's the other miracle. We were able to make a better product at a lower price, and we were able to sell a lot of product. And we would sell in the toy aisle, but they owned the checkout aisle. They just would not let us in there because basically they owned that space. In fact, we won a venue battle. After TC Heartland, we won a venue battle because they lease space in these retail stores. It was a really interesting side story.
Now, going back, obviously we mentioned your litigation, but you mentioned about finding the right patent litigation attorneys. Any insight about that? One of the main attorneys that you had, he's a generalist litigation attorney. What advice would you give to somebody who's kind of trying to figure out?
Yeah, my team did great. Some of them were more general, and then we assembled the proper team along the way. But we were important to them. So how do you get top-notch counsel when most of them are at big firms and they have big clients? And so you're not going to get their best work. That's the hard thing. So find someone who's aggressive, who will learn the law, learn best practices in the patent space because it is unique, and then manage it. It's like I had my own in-house counsel, and my own in-house counsel keep an eye on things. And then contingencies are a mess. There was a time when contingencies were effective way to get representation. And what I'm finding, the vendors I'm meeting, it's hard to get a contingency deal. It's getting harder and harder. The ones that are getting them are getting these gunslingers who are like, yeah, I'll file a complaint. This guy will pay me millions of dollars and I'll win. And then 6 months in, they're like, oh crap, I've got counterclaims. I've got depositions. I've got out of pocket costs. And they don't have the depth to win this case. They start losing the inventor's rights one piece at a time. And so these guys are getting contingency, but then they're getting these cases, they're getting underwater and they can't get out of it. And before you know it, they have to settle, lose their rights. So those are the pitfalls. The answer is go get $20 million and hire a firm that's connected to the patent office, that's connected to DC, it's connected to the courts. They got to go to the bench bar associations. They got to be sponsors. You got to get... It's an inside game. And so how do you do that? What kind of advice is that for an inventor?
Yeah. So I hear at least two important pieces of advice. One advice is that find counsel that will prioritize your case in the right way. Second is be careful about somebody willing to take your case on a contingency basis if they don't have the proper resources to see it through. I mean, one thing that you hear a lot about is litigation financing these days. Would something like that have helped your case, or is that not? Some of these cases have to be really big. I don't know. What are your thoughts about that avenue? Is that helping inventors or
litigation financing? You've got to, the numbers have to work. So you either have to team up with a whole bunch of other inventors or basically sell your patents to a patent assertion entity. And so that's not really litigation. I mean, that's basically you're transferring ownership and you're basically discounting your patent to get rid of it. And that's a good, if you can do that, but it's going to be hard to make money. If you spent 7 years of sunk cost and opportunity cost, and you're not going to get $1 million for your patent. So that's a hard one. You can get maybe $100,000 for a patent. But then otherwise, to get a contingency firm for your own portfolio, you've got to have $100 million damages model. So you've got to be suing, you know, you got to be in the tech space. You got to be suing smartphone or networking companies or something that has a huge damages model. Because these litigation financers are going to have to pay these high quality connected attorneys, and they may do a hybrid. At the end of the day, to bring these guys to the table is going to cost you tens of millions of dollars. You look, and maybe more. Vernetics is probably, I think they won. It was almost 10 years, and they must have spent $50 million.
Yeah, that's a big litigation against Apple.
Yeah.
They recently, the Supreme Court didn't take them up on it.
So contingencies, like, you've got to have, even $100 million is like borderline. Like, it needs to be half a billion to get a contingency firm. Because these guys got to put food on their table. They've got to have 8 or 10 attorneys doing depositions, going to trial, because you got to go to trial now before they'll even talk to you. And usually you have to go to trial multiple times. You got to find someone who knows what it takes to bring these guys to the table and has the depth to go do it. And they have to be paid.
Even though you had the most popular toy in America, even for somebody like you, these weren't really realistic options in terms of litigation financing or anything like that that you hear about.
I don't think so, but I hear there's some people that disagree with me. They tell me what we would take that case. We won $31 million, but maybe we could have spent less. But if you don't litigate 110%, the other guys are, and you may not lose, but you're creating vulnerability. You got to file as many motions as they do. You got to file as many appeals as they do. It's scorched earth. Yeah. If you don't go scorched earth, then you're compromising your position.
And in your case, when you did find that litigation counsel, were they able to provide an estimate or an assurance about how it would go? Like, we'll have to fight it for 3 years, but eventually they'll settle? Or were they like, we have no idea what will happen? I guess, what kind of guidance did they provide you?
I don't think any of us knew. I don't think we had any idea. You can look at the numbers. It says, like, the average cost to go to trial is $3 to $5 million. I guess we didn't. I don't know. I don't know.
When you were going into it, were you hoping it would get, I know I've asked you this question several times, were you hoping that it would get resolved in some manner? Or did you think it might be a years-long fight that it turned out to be?
I didn't know. We were just treading water. Like, we just have to stop these guys. And it all focused on the preliminary injunction motion initially. That was we jumped right in. That's almost the equivalent of a trial. The motion practice, the hearing, the expense. And so it all revolved around that preliminary injunction. And I remember we didn't know if we'd get it because the standard is really hard. Yeah. Irreparable harm, likelihood of success, especially when they're filing PTAB challenges in parallel. They go to the court and say, well, they instituted review, so how could he say he's likely to succeed? When that decision came out and we were granted the preliminary injunction, I remember it was euphoric. I called my wife. I said, we won. I really thought that was
And that's because preliminary injunctions are extremely rare these days, almost impossible to get. And the fact
that and that meant they had to stop. We would be able to go build our business now. I guess it would go to trial, or maybe not. But 3 weeks later, they started launching their version B of the knockoff.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
So that's another part of the story. They started making little variations. I mean, do you think their goal was to kind of make you give up and run out of money, or
this business model worked? Has worked for 35 years, so we just keep doing it. By the way, the first law firm wasn't getting it done, so they brought in David Boyce, famous attorney
on
the Supreme Court.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
Oh gosh. And then they didn't get the job done, so they brought in Morgan Chu of Ireland Manella. We go back and look, and one of the law journals publishes a list of the 10 lawyers who are paid who earn $2,000 an hour. They had two of them working for them. And so they just doubled down. They're like, we're not going to stop. This always works. He'll go away eventually.
And do you think from their point of view, the danger of settling with you is that they'll have a more difficult time infringing other products? Is that because to them, you know, they must be spending tens of millions of dollars at this point as well?
Well, they dug themselves a hole, and there was this point where they didn't have any way out. And the only way out was to spend another $10 or $20 million in litigation. And that just made the hole deeper. And so it was a really hairy decision point for them. If they had owed us much more than $31 million, I think they would have gone bankrupt and hid the money. If they'd owed us a little bit less, they were like, we'd rather pay the lawyers than pay the inventor. The economics just worked out. And plus, they were only a $1 billion company. I say only, right? Yeah. because this actually mattered. When they're spending this amount of money to try to get away with stealing my invention, it actually was affecting their bottom line. Whereas if they were a multi-billion dollar company, that I wouldn't be here. We'd still be in court for 10 years.
And it seems like a lot of things lined up. We won't have much time to discuss this, but the PTAB proceedings, which you mentioned, your patents got upheld, even though it was instituted. I understand they were upheld on final decision, which is also a relatively rare feat. I mean, there was a point where the movie came out, everybody was closely following your case, I think, in the patent community. And there was a sense, well, if you don't succeed, then the patent system might be in even worse shape than anybody imagined. But it took all these things to line up. And finally, from what I understand, the judgment that the district court made was $30 million, and you settled for $31 million. Usually when you think about a settlement, you're forced to kind of meet in the middle somewhere. How did that settlement finally come about? Can you tell us, I guess, a little backstory about?
My first trial got postponed because the PTAB did cancel my patent. I had to appeal that. They wouldn't let us go ahead. I think they should, and I don't think the PTAB decisions can be binding on a district court. The standards are totally different. I don't think the law supports that. But our judge postponed our trial. And then the second version, we actually got to the jury trial before the PTAB issued their final decision. So we got a jury. The jury found willful.
So was that with different judges or same judge?
In the PTAB?
Or the district court?
District court, same judge.
Okay.
Same judge. Yeah. The first one got postponed because I didn't have a patent anymore. Okay. And the second one, we got to the jury while the PTAB was still deliberating. And they found willful infringement and awarded us $12 million. And then post-trial, 18 months post-trial motions. But at the end of that, the judge doubled it for willfulness. I guess you got to kill somebody to get triple. And then awarded us attorney's fees and interest. It all came out to $31 million. So that triggered a 30-day appeal timeline. So now they're having to go find $31 million to post bond, sell a yacht or a plane or something to go get the money. Plus, they had two more trials coming up. And then I was shocked. They went from ridiculous offers a few months before to wanting to have an actual settlement discussion. And they wanted to vacate the judgment and file a confidential settlement. I'm like, are you kidding me? You lost. You're not going to ever go to another jury and say, we're not guilty because we've never lost. And so that judgment was upheld. And they had to pay a substantial sum in addition to resolve the other pending cases.
It seems the fact that they had these other cases looming, they didn't want to take the risk of spending more and keep losing. They're like, let's just resolve everything at this point. Do you think that's finally what kind of made them?
Once I got my first patent back and then the second and third patent came to life, and after we burned our patents, they changed judges on my case of the PTAB. Wow. I got a favorable final written decision, which they get to appeal. But after that had happened, there came this point where like, dang, this guy's not going away. And I told him, I said, we'll litigate this for 10 years. Enjoy paying your $2,000 an hour attorneys for 10 years. And it finally set in that this guy's not going away. We were just really fortunate. We were selling hundreds of millions of dollars in water balloons all over the world. So I could stand up to the bully just because we had the resources to do it. There's no other way.
Right. And usually it's kind of the tactics that the accused patent infringers use to make the patent owner run out of resources. In this case, the only reason you were able to win is because they knew you weren't going to back down and you were actually going to make them start feeling the pain of this litigation. Is that?
Yeah. I won my patent rights because we were able to compete without them. If I'd have needed my patent rights to build my business, I wouldn't have been able to have them.
I guess another interesting part is you kind of took... It didn't benefit you personally to have it publicly disclosed, the settlement, but for the entire patent system, obviously, that was something that was important to you.
I don't remember. It wasn't really a point of contention. You know, there's some hairy moments where the idea of a gag order was floated, like, what would I do if I couldn't talk about the case? And you know, it's just the point where we had the leverage. We're like, we don't have to negotiate any. It's unconditional surrender. So it was unusual to be in that position.
And you wrote an article about it for IP Watchdog, but I think at one point you spent $17 million on the legal fees, as that the article said. And so at least half of your judgment had to go towards the legal fee. Is that the...
I'd have to disclose an undisclosable number for you to do the arithmetic.
Yeah.
The net cost at the end of the day was $20 million.
I guess now that you have the benefit, obviously... it seemed like everything lined up correctly in your case. For example, if you didn't have new PTAB judges, if you had PTAB judges that were more hostile, it might have not worked out the same way. I mean, if you had to go through that process again, is there anything that you would have done differently? Or I guess any advice to somebody who might be in your position in the future, who might be taking on a company like Telebrands?
There are people right now. There's people, they don't know what to do. I tell them to go get $20 million. Then we're stuck. There's nothing you can do. You didn't exactly ask the question, would I do it again? I was trying to think, what would I do if I knew what I know? It wouldn't be prudent to pursue your patent rights. It causes massive financial and psychological cost to inventors who try to do that. I'm a very, very rare exception. Lottery winner.
Did any part of you think after you were able to reach that settlement, well, maybe the patent system does work in some way, or did you realize that you were kind of the exception to the...
I can't call this working. A lot of people in the industry want me to. The director of the patent office would like me to say good things about the patent system. Yeah. And in good conscience, I just can't. I'm too analytical for that. You know, the numbers don't work. The numbers don't work. I don't like it. That's why I want to fix it.
You're a father of eight. You were helping launch this huge product. You had this complex litigation going on. And at the same time, you became a champion for the patent system. Can you talk about why you decided that was necessary? Why did you decide you need to get involved in the politics of it and the advocacy on the Capitol Hill side of it? What moved you to do that?
I checked the docket one morning like I always do at the PTAB. They had instituted a review of my second and third patents. I was losing my patents as I could get them, and they were going right back through again. And I said, this system isn't working. What else can I do? I was desperate. I came to Washington. I came to Alexandria, the patent office, because nothing else was working. The system was broken. So I sat there. I went to the patent office and sat there for 3 days until the commissioner would meet with me. I wouldn't go away. I didn't bother meeting with the director at the time.
And that's Commissioner Drew Herschel?
It was, yeah. Yeah. So finally he comes down, and at the end of one day.
Were you literally sitting?
I was there 3 days in a row, morning and night, and morning and evening, afternoon, because I had to tell him what's going on. I mean, this was the examiner that you mentioned earlier who was doing his job very well. The PTAB was completely off the reservation, completely crazy. The prior art was on the face of the patent. They're saying, it would have been obvious to combine a garden sprinkler with a gastrointestinal dietary balloon. It was nonsense. Yeah.
So what did he tell you once you met with him?
He couldn't tell me anything because his boss was head of patents for Google. And so I feel like he understood what I was going through and that it was nothing he could do about it. The examining division.
Did he say, I feel really bad about, like, what
no.
is it?
No. He seemed, I felt like he cared. Yeah, okay. It's really sad how, you know, the commissioner of patents used to be the head of America's innovation agency and all the respect. It was a very important role. They've been kicked off as stepchildren now. It's all about the bureaucracy and the management and the attorneys. And so he had no power. I went to a meeting with a public meeting, and there was an open mic, and I explained my story to chief of staff for the director. A few months later, we had this patent burning protest. But it was this group, a few inventors under the umbrella of US Inventor, who helped me when I got here. I had no idea where to go. They explained how the Judiciary Committee is who writes the patent laws, and they helped me get around the Hill. And they really helped me turn my case around through the publicity, that wasn't the intent. I came here out of desperation. I don't know what to do. I guess this is that First Amendment petitioning the government for redress of grievances would be where it would fit. I didn't know what to do. And then serendipitously, it actually helped turn my case around. But anyway, I met these guys, and then, you know, they were supportive, and then I got more involved and started meeting lots of other inventors. And so I was spending, you know, I had one leg and do 3 days a week litigation and 2 days policy. And then that just transitioned as we got ahead in the litigation. I spent more and more time in policy, and now I'm full-time volunteering to advocate for inventors.
And did you try to meet with your congressman? I don't know, who was your congressman at the time? Or
yeah, he's not on the right committee.
So he wasn't helpful. Does that bring you right now? It was a transition, obviously.
But my senators, any of your listeners in Texas, I've been trying to meet with Senator Cruz and Senator Cornyn, who are on the proper committee, for 3 years now. If there's someone out there who can get me an appointment to explain to them, they do not know what's going on, and they've never spoken with an inventor or entrepreneur about the patent system. All they hear from is lobbyists and lawyers. So I need to meet with those guys and explain to them what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's so odd, and I saw that they don't want to meet with you. You're obviously a huge success story from Texas. Even if you didn't have these issues, they should be meeting with you to kind of get your sense as an entrepreneur there. So yeah, I think that's definitely important. I want to talk a little bit about the Judiciary Committee, I guess your sense of what's going on there now. Obviously, Daryl Issa was pretty hostile towards patents, but now you have Doc Hollins, who's been more pretty patent friendly, and now very say Jim Jordan, at least on the minority side. I guess are you seeing that there is any kind of change on Capitol Hill, any kind of swing towards being more patent-friendly on these type of issues?
Well, these guys with U.S. Inventor, Paul Morinville and Randy Landrieu, and some others in the industry had begun to stop the damage back in 2014. So before I knew them, they had been having some influence. And so this perspective is being heard by some members, some senators, staffers. So I think we've stopped the damage. I think people are recognizing that there is an infringer lobby, and they've done some damage. The idea that I've had chairs of the Judiciary Committee have communicated to me that there's unintended consequences associated with the America Invents Act. So the recognition's there that there's a problem. There's no will to fix it.
And you mean it's just not a priority-wise, or because of the opposing side, the interests that don't want it fixed are not going to let it happen?
Yeah, it's the opposition, and it's too hard to do the right thing.
And U.S. inventors, and you mentioned some of the creative tactics that you've used. You had to resort to literally burning your patents outside the patent office to try to get attention to these issues. Mm-hmm. But obviously, you've also tried to do the more traditional things, which is meeting with congressmen, trying to tell your story. I guess two questions. I mean, from your experience, how do you weigh what tactics would work? And also, I mean, what do you think will finally need to happen for Congress to embrace these issues and prioritize them in the right way and make the changes that need to happen?
We do a good job keeping each other accountable to not be subsumed by the swamp. So there's a way of doing things. You hire lobbyists, you work both sides of the issue, you pay them lots of money, you get involved in... I'm starting to learn kind of how the traditional way of doing things in Washington, and give and get and trade and horse trade. And we don't have quite enough political power to even play that game. And then just, we have an obligation. I mean, these guys fought for me when I had no idea what was going on. I probably never read one of these newsletters that said that the patent system is being sold out to special interests. I just said, of course you can't, that can't be happening. And so we have to be pure and principled in what we're fighting for. If you want to repeal the Patent Act, go ahead and vote to repeal it. If you don't want to give patents on any software-related inventions, go ahead and write that in the statute. But quit jerking us around with patents that we can't enforce. That's what they've done. You know, they want to do lots of studies to get more people involved in patenting. And so the tactics, like when they took an Emmy award-winning invention, this wireless recording microphone of Zaxcom, and they ran them to the PTAB, and not only did they take them to the PTAB, they took them to the annual convention of the AIPLA as a show trial. This guy won a freaking Emmy Award for technical achievement and an Academy Award for his invention that lists the limitations of the claims on the face of the award, and they canceled his patent. And so when that happened, I said, I'm going to stand up for this guy. I don't care if anybody joins me. It's not a tactic. It's a cause. Could not let that go by. It's so offensive to me the way they treat inventors. And so there's some of that.
You meet these inventors, and it's not a theoretical thing. It's a practical thing where people's lives are being negatively impacted because they were relying on these patent rights, which they turned out did not really exist or were impossible to enforce. I mean, one thing in the Invalidated, at least documentary, there were some very impressive people on that documentary, Leo, obviously, who were very helpful to the Trump administration and are obviously very influential on a lot of issues. But it seems like, what is your sense about how the administration is doing on these issues? Did you have any expectations overall?
There was a glimmer of hope during oil states when a lot of property rights groups recognized what was happening and filed amicus briefs. But the DOJ, the solicitor's office at the USPTO, it's not getting through. They think patents are special. And so the way it works is the DOJ represents the government in these cases. And so the solicitor general makes the argument, but usually it's staff attorneys who create these arguments. It's the same arguments they, you know, in 2015 in the Obama administration, it's the exact same theories and doctrines and a lot of the same people that they said that there's no separation of powers problem. You can have an administrative tribunal in America taking away property rights. There's no Seventh Amendment right to a trial by jury. Those were resolved, the Supreme Court decided against us in oil states. But over the last year, they're saying that there's no appointments clause problem. These judges we know nothing about. They say all rise when they walk in the room. And they were hired, most of them, by Michelle Lee, head of patents for Google. Most of them have no technical qualifications other than a Bachelor of Science degree in engineering. And they've been declared unconstitutional because the Senate didn't confirm them for this incredibly important job. The administration says that's okay. I don't think the president thinks it's okay, but the people that work for him say it's okay. And now the Fifth Amendment. Now inventors are saying, okay, this is a fake patent. It's a public franchise, according to this new theory. You can give it to us. You can take it away. Fine. Now pay us. You have to compensate us for the taking. The attorneys of the DOJ and at the patent office say, nope, it's not a taking. We can give you a patent. We can change the terms of the patent. We can take away the patent. That means you never had a patent, so nothing was taken. And that's the current attitude about patents. And it's just this industry. It's just it's not good for innovation. It's not good for entrepreneurs. It's not good for catching up with China.
You mentioned him, but USPTO Director Andre Iancu, I think he was a vast improvement over his immediate predecessors. And he's spoken about the problems, about the patent troll narrative, about why patents are important. A lot of the things that you speak about, what the U.S. inventors speak about, he seems to share those feelings. And at least at the patent office, to me at least, it seems that he's tried to implement a lot of the changes to restrain the PTAB from invalidating patents and allowing endless proceedings to do so. I'm guessing you've had conversations with him about all of this. What does he tell you? Does he tell you that wait is going to get better, or does he say that Congress needs to do something? What is his message to you in terms of where we stand?
I don't know if I'm free to share his exact words, but I believe the president appointed him to lead our national innovation policy. Yeah. And I believe he's got the right heart, but you know, he's got to take bolder action. So there's many people in the administration that work for him and around him and at the DOJ and at the White House that are undermining, that are working directly against his vision and our vision and every patriotic American's vision for what the patent system should be. And so he's going to have to take a more bold leadership and passing rules and creating presidential opinion panels and propping up the PTAB is not the way forward.
There are going to be major changes. What do you think they need to be? I'm guessing one of them will be getting rid of the PTAB. Aside from that, even if the PTAB wasn't around, your litigation would have been super expensive. Do you have any thoughts about like what changes need to take place to kind of make it easier for patent owners to enforce the rights?
Well, the system is perceived as being balanced for large corporate interests. So you've got big tech on one side that wants to use patents without paying for them, and you've got pharmaceutical companies and non-practicing entities and licensing companies on the other side who would like their portfolios to be of higher value and their profits to be greater. What's missing from that is the little guy. You know, we don't have 1,000 patents. You know, the big guys are like, yeah, we lose 300 patents on Alice and at the PTAB. We've still got 700. We can monetize that. Well, you've wiped out our business when you make us litigate our patents. Congress has to pass a solution that restores. I mean, this is Clause 8, right?
Yeah.
So we have to secure to inventors the exclusive right to their discoveries. And so we've got to have some legislation that gives that to inventors. There's a bill out there, the Inventor Rights Act, H.R. 5478, that would restore reliable patent rights for inventors who hold on to their patents. So we can't be strengthening patent rights for drug companies and patent trolls. That won't pass. There's just not a consensus that it's a good thing to do. So we got to give back rights to the entrepreneurs that need them to get back in the game.
I have a lot of friends who come up with ideas and they reach out to me about, they're thinking about applying a patent. I tell them about the hard journey and that getting a patent kind of doesn't guarantee anything. I mean, what advice would you give to, on a lot of different levels, but to somebody who says, I want to be the next Josh Malone, come up with the next great American innovation? What advice in terms of innovating and in terms of protecting that innovation?
Well, you do what you do. Invent as much as you can, as often as you can, with as much resources as you can afford to invest. And then give 10% to the cause. So unfortunately, and I didn't do this, our patent system has been stolen from us. And so we have to lobby, we have to participate in our representative government if we want to get it back. So we've all got to pitch in, you know, give 10%, give a half a day a week, go to usinventor.org and join the movement, attend town halls, attend meetings. We're helping you do that. It's moving the ball. When these guys hear from a constituent who's a small business owner, they listen. So join the cause so that we can restore our patent rights so that you and your children can pursue that dream and be inventors.
I guess one last question. When you're successful at this one day, or if this wasn't an issue, what would you like to be doing right now? What's your aspirations besides trying to fix the patent system?
I appreciate the way you formulated that. You've touched on it. So I do this because I feel compelled to, and it's a platform that you know I have that no one else has. And so I could go back and invent. I have some resources now. I could do that, and I would love to do that. But I'm only one little brain. I'd rather have 500,000 inventors flourishing and getting investors and getting licenses and turning that into the next big thing. As you noted, that's where I'm adding the most value right now. But yeah, I mean, if we could pass a substantial part of our legislative agenda, oh my gosh. I don't know if I could be ever as, when you're desperate and you're creative, things happen, but I would hope I could get to that point where I could solve some other really important problems of the world. I'd love to be an inventor full time again.
I'm sure we're going to come across your other great innovations one day. So thank you so much for joining Clause 8. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.